From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And lawmakers in Washington are moving quickly to enhance safety and security for Supreme Court justices. Last night, abortion rights protesters gathered outside the home of Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote the draft opinion that would overturn nearly 50 years of abortion rights in this country.
Also in the nation's capital, the maternal mortality rate is one of the highest in the country, disproportionately affecting Black women. And supporters of abortion rights say any new restrictions will make things worse. Dr. Jamila Parrott is president of Physicians for Reproductive Health and a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are also a member of the Maternal Mortality Review Committee in Washington, D.C. If abortion becomes illegal in many states, assuming Roe v. Wade is overturned, what are the implications for Black women, Black mothers?
I think, you know, it's important that we talk about both of these things together always. You know, the maternal mortality, pregnancy, contraception, abortion, they happen for all of us in a continuum. And research shows that states with the highest numbers of abortion restrictions are the same states with poorer maternal health outcomes. And while most people certainly will go on to have healthy pregnancies, some are going to experience illnesses or chronic conditions where pregnancy can cause serious health problems, if not death. When abortion is difficult or impossible to access, then complicated health conditions can worsen for many communities.
And are there places, are there states, perhaps the District of Columbia, where African-American women will be particularly at risk if abortion becomes illegal in certain places?
The District of Columbia is where I live and work and where I grew up is certainly one place where we're going to see an impact directly on health outcomes for so many of our communities. But we can turn our eyes to places where this already exists. Louisiana is an example. Louisiana has very restrictive abortion laws. They also have one of the highest maternal mortality rates of any state in this country. Similarly, we see abysmal maternal mortality outcomes in the state of Texas, and we know that they have passed law after law, have enacted legislation after legislation restricting access to abortion care. It's important that we understand that these two things are connected. And the way that they're connected is because they are deeply tied to our agency and autonomy and our personal liberty, our ability to make decisions about our bodies, our lives, and our futures.
So as you think about a woman in a state where abortion before long may be illegal, how do you think about the options then for that person, that woman, and her provider?
Well, the options are often limited for folks where care is restricted. And so the options are to remain pregnant. There's strong evidence that really points to long-term health and societal consequences for those who sought abortion care, including economic impacts, including educational impacts, family and community impacts. The option is to travel, right? We are seeing people who have been traveling from states like Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, trying to access care in neighboring states. If you have money, if you have resources, if you can find child care for the children you have, take time off work, all of those things have to exist in order for you to be able to travel. And that is not the reality for most of the people that we care for. The third option is that folks have always accessed abortion care, whether it was legal, whether it was restricted or not, and they will continue to do so regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court ruling. What we see is folks have accessed abortion care outside of the formal medical system because of the availability of medication abortion in particular. So folks have been able to access these medications, and we know the real risk here is not medical when we're talking about folks managing their own care, but instead it is legal because we're going to see an uptick of folks and folks who are criminalized, who are arrested, interrogated, prosecuted, imprisoned for self-managing their abortion. We have seen it happen already in this country, and I believe with increasing restrictions, we're going to see this happen more frequently.
Dr. Parrott, I wonder if you as a provider are worried for providers of these services, because a number of state legislatures are seeking to hold liable physicians, providers for offering these services, especially for patients who may cross state lines to get them.
That's certainly a concern that I have and one that many of my colleagues share. We know that when healthcare providers are put in those positions, it keeps people from care. It makes our communities less safe. That's not the way we want care delivered in this country or anywhere for that matter.
Dr. Jamila Parrott is an OBGYN and president of Physicians for Reproductive Health. Dr. Parrott, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow morning, the state of Arizona will execute a prisoner for the first time in nearly 8 years. A 66-year-old blind man with schizophrenia named Clarence Dixon is scheduled to die by lethal injection, sentenced to death for murdering a college student in 1978. Despite pleas from Dixon's lawyers, Governor Doug Ducey says he will let the execution go as planned.
I believe in certain situations, the death penalty is justice.
Matthew Casey is a senior reporter with KJZZ in Phoenix. He joins us now. Welcome.
Good morning.
Well, and Dixon's lawyers say it's unconstitutional to execute him because he is mentally ill. A judge rejected that argument. As we said, so has the governor there. Is Clarence Dixon out of options?
He's getting close, but not quite. His defense team has challenged the makeup of the clemency board, the drug he's to be injected with, and the competency issue. The state Supreme Court threw out the appeal on that issue yesterday. His team is expected to take it to federal court. I don't have a response yet back on whether it has actually been filed. And as you mentioned, he has 24 hours until he's scheduled to be executed.
And this will be the first execution in Arizona in so many years because there's been concern over the drugs used, as there are in other states. In 2014, a Catholic deacon, Ed Sheffer, witnessed the execution of Joseph Wood. It took 15 injections before he died. Let's listen.
Then I was praying the rosary for him, and it took a little over an hour and 58 minutes, and clearly, nobody was comfortable in that room.
An hour and almost two. What has happened since 2014 to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, Wood was executed with a cocktail of midazolam and hydromorphone. So that's different than what the state aims to use tomorrow on Mr. Dixon. In 2014, a state-commissioned report gave no explanation why it took almost 2 hours for Dixon to die and found no problems with the execution procedure or staff training. What it recommended was going from that two-drug mix to phenobarbital, which it described as effective and reliable. That's exactly what the state aims to do. Pentobarbital is a barbiturate. It's been very hard to find for use in executions going back years. Arizona reportedly spent about $1.5 million to get it, and they tried to restart executions last year, but it was unsuccessful. The state's execution procedure manual says Dixon is supposed to be injected with a total of 5 grams of pentobarbital in two doses.
Well, we heard Governor Ducey say this is justice being served. What does the family of the victim, the college student, say?
Well, her name was Dina Bowden. She went to Arizona State University, and she was found raped, stabbed, and strangled with a belt. Dixon was convicted of that. Her sister, Bowden's sister, Leslie, spoke about the brutal way Dina died at the recent state clemency hearing. And the AP quoted her as telling the board there is no legal, social, or moral imperative to spare Dixon.
Okay. Terrible, terrible murder. Well, in early June, there's another execution scheduled for a second inmate. Do you get the sense that Arizona's ready to resume executions after a nearly 8-year pause?
Well, the state certainly believes it is. I think we will find out more tomorrow, obviously. One of the legal issues that's still outstanding is concern about the drug that the pentobarbital that's supposed to be injected into Dixon. The state has said that it will mix a new batch It has a very short period of time to do that, to satisfy Mr. Dixon's lawyers. And so the expired judge claim or an expired drug claim or an issue with that could still delay the execution, but the state definitely wants to proceed tomorrow at 10 a.m.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey there in Phoenix, Arizona, as that state has its first execution scheduled for tomorrow, first in 8 years. Matthew, thank you so much for reporting to us. Tough story.
Thank you for having me.
In the Philippines, the son of the infamous dictator Ferdinand Marcos appears set to become the country's next president. Marcos Sr. was driven into exile by a popular revolt back in 1986. Now, early election results show Marcos Jr. winning a landslide victory over his closest rival, Lenny Robredo. Stunning, because Marcos's father and mother stole billions of dollars from the Philippines. His father imposed a brutal martial law. So what does the sun's rise mean? NPR's Julie McCarthy is in Manila. And Julie, this is a remarkable comeback for the Marcos family. You know, given this history, we remember Marcos's mother, the former beauty queen, and the closets of designer shoes she bought from around the world. How did Marcos Jr., who goes by the nickname Bong Bong, stage this comeback?
Well, it really is an extraordinary twist of history, turn of history, history coming full circle, you know. Mm. You know, this is something that is a decades-long project with this family, and the architect is the former First Lady, Imelda Marcos. She told the producers of the documentary Kingmaker that she missed the prestige of being First Lady, not the palace, but the clout. And in that conversation, she acknowledged that her long-held wish was that her only son would follow in the footsteps of her husband and become president. This is a long, well-thought-out campaign to rehabilitate the name and to basically rewrite the history of that legacy.
But how do you do that? Because that history also includes, you know, economic collapse, a brutal reign of martial law. I want to ask, how much did current President Rodrigo Duterte's daughter, Sarah, running for vice president on this Marcos Jr. ticket, how much influence did she have?
Oh, I think she had pull. She had pull in the south of the country, certainly. There are bases in Mindanao and Davao City. Mm-hmm. She's a formidable candidate because she's perceived to be a strong administrator. She's a tough cookie. She surrounds herself with technocrats. She's referred to as Duterte Light, meaning her father. I don't know her well enough to even make that kind of extrapolation, but I think it's quite an unfair kind of rendering of what she brings to the table. But she has the benefit and the draw of being the daughter of a man who remains, after 6 years in office, extremely popular, even despite everything that's happened here. I mean, the economy is a wreck. The pandemic has decimated this place, and of course, you know, in many ways, the Philippines was put in an extremely negative light under the rule of Duterte and his very bloody drug war, which is now the subject of the international criminal courts.
Right, people assassinated under his direction. These are dynasties now for decades. What does that mean for the Philippines?
It means that they will suck the democratic oxygen out of the room. And what it does is it just locks people out of the democratic process. It locks people out who would join and renew the blood of democracy by running for office. It's not policy driven. It is personality driven. And it's who has the most name recognition.
Well, you tell us that the Presidential Commission on Good Government has spent decades trying to recover money stolen by the Marcoses. Mm-hmm. What is that, and what happens to that?
That, for many people, is the $64 million question, no pun intended. They wonder themselves what would happen to it. the detractors detractors of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. fear that he will find a way to defang that commission. He will find a way somehow to perhaps quietly kill it. This is an operation that has, over the years, as of last March 2021, collected in excess of $3 billion worth of ill-gotten gains back from the Marcos family. And there are many more billions out there, at least that amount. And the work of that commission goes on, and it's a long, slow slog.
I just have to ask you quickly about Lenny Robredo, who was Marcos's closest rival, and you say the most trolled public official online?
Absolutely. You know, and that started when she beat Marcos for the vice presidency in 2016. He did not forgive it. He didn't forget it. He launched a campaign against her, challenged her for 5 years in the courts, and labeled her a cheater. And it turned into a, just kind of a vicious campaign that escalated the trolls who have gone after Lenny Robredo for the fact that she's a woman. And the fact that she was still standing in a rather grounded way, talking about clean government and an end to dynasties, is really kind of a testament to resilience in many ways.
NPR correspondent Julie McCarthy in Manila in the Philippines. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine is escalating a food crisis in the poorest countries. The war has raised fuel prices, pushing up the cost of transport. And on top of that, there is a wheat shortage from producers Russia and Ukraine. And that is being felt in a place with enough problems, Afghanistan. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
Women, concealed under blue burqas, wait for free bread outside a bakery on a Kabul road. Behind them, a group of men also wait. It's late afternoon. People are desperate. One do-gooder tries to distribute loaves of Afghan flatbread that he's just purchased, and a fight breaks out. "It's mine," a woman shouts. A man, Atik Ahmadi, says, "You got one already. This one is mine." Ahmadi says, "Just ask the baker. He was watching." The fight subsides, and Ahmadi tells NPR's Kabul producer, Fazul Minallah Kazizai, that he used to make about $170 a month repairing equipment at the defense ministry. That had been enough to feed his five children. But there's been no work since the Taliban seized power, a move that prompted Washington to freeze $7 billion worth of Afghan assets. And that freeze has rippled across Afghanistan's fragile economy. Civil servants haven't been paid. Contractors like Ahmadi lost work. There's no cash to hire labourers for jobs.
That is obviously contributing to a new class of hungry people.
Shelley Thakral is a spokesperson for the World Food Programme. She says there's other factors.
There's been a drought that's also contributing to hunger. There's an economic crisis that's also contributing to hunger.
An economic crisis partly caused by the pandemic. She says people are desperate.
More than 80% they've had to borrow to pay for food, selling their household items just to be able to afford food. No very extreme cases where they've resorted to selling their children into early marriage.
Graham Smith, a senior consultant on Afghanistan for the International Crisis Group, says even as millions of people were thrown into poverty after the Taliban takeover, the actual price of food in the market went up by 30 to 40%.
When you put it in sort of real terms, like a laborer goes out and works in the field, that day's labor buys about one-third less food.
Now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has added its own hardship. The two countries produce about a third of the world's exported wheat. While Afghanistan largely imports from the Central Asian country of Kazakhstan, it's seen knock-on effects. Xiaowei Li is a deputy director of the World Food Programme in Afghanistan.
There is now fewer sources for everybody to tap into. And so it has been driving up global commodity prices, which means that it is more expensive for us. We've seen that already. For example, we're now tendering for wheat flour from Pakistan, that prices are likely to increase.
Consider that the World Food Programme assists about one-fifth of all Afghans. So less money is less food for millions of hungry people. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has also triggered a global shortage in cooking oil, and rising fuel prices mean the cost of transporting all those goods is rising. That's also being reflected in Kabul's bazaars, where the prices are rising. Again, trader Abdelmateen Rahimi says wheat went up by another 20% after the invasion. And the bigger calamity might still be on its way. Smith from the crisis group again.
I think the real struggle for Afghanistan will come next winter.
When domestic supplies of wheat are exhausted, when current contracts for wheat end, and
the whole world is trying to scramble for limited supplies, and Afghanistan will be one of the least able to compete.
And some of the world's most vulnerable customers may be left behind. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
The cigarette maker Philip Morris International is trying to buy one of its rivals, a company you may not have heard of. It's called Swedish Match. It sells nicotine pouches you put in your mouth and other smokeless tobacco products. And those alternatives are a big part of Philip Morris's plans to diversify beyond traditional cigarettes. Our traditional business analyst, Robin Farzad, joins us. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, hey.
How are you, Scott?
Swedish Match. Its big seller is this nicotine pouch called Zyn. Tell us about this product and this company.
Yes, the company is actually a venerable Swedish, Scandinavian national champion of Sweden. If you can go back and look at its history over the 20th century, making matches, cigars, historically cigarettes and everything. But the Swedes have been pretty self-flagellating about the harms of smoking and oral cancer and chewing tobacco and everything. So they've been pretty forward about snus, which is an alternative product here where you have the nicotine in a pouch that just delivers it to you transdermally through the lip without the spitting, without the smoke, without the, involving the lungs. And that has snapped up a lot of market share in gas stations and convenience stores in the United States. And so this gigantic international tobacco and cigarette giant wants to snap up some of that market share.
Yeah, and let's talk about this growing new market. There's this whole world of non-traditional products, lozenges, chewing tobacco, these pouches, e-cigarettes. What's really moving this market, this new part of the market?
Well, the fact that you can take this bifurcation over the past 7 or 8 years, first with e-cigarettes, but then with Juul, which Philip Morris's U.S. cousin, Altria, which owns Philip Morris USA, bought a controlling stake in. That was a killer app, no pun intended, in that people who used it thought that it was really helpful in getting off of cigarettes. But the unintended consequences of that concentrated nicotine hit was it was getting teens involved in this in droves, and Altria got a lot of pushback. So everybody's looking for the perfect transitional device. Philip Morris International had IQOS, which is heat, not burn, and they're saying that's not good enough. That doesn't quite get you there. So the idea is this could finally get PM International over the hump in terms of a smoke-free future.
Now, Philip Morris is historically one of the world's biggest cigarette companies, clearly trying to evolve, as you're describing, diversify away from smoking. Is this a big identity shift here for the brand?
And it's hugely controversial. Both Philip Morris USA and International keep talking about a smoke-free future. But if you look at their earnings statements now, it's decidedly cigarette-centric. So is there cognitive dissonance in this? But in a sense, they're kind of being digitally disrupted. And you can kind of, ride the declining annuity of traditional cigarettes, but the stock market's going to penalize you. So they've gotten into cannabis. They've gotten into kind of borderline pharmaceuticals, other inhalation delivery devices. It's a brave, scary new world for big tobacco.
Yeah. And briefly, Robin, there may be new regulations in the U.S. kind of limiting access to some of these products. Are they trying to get ahead of this too?
Yeah, and ahead of what we recently discussed with the menthol ban, that was a profit center. And whether that happens in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, they see the writing on the wall that their traditional profit centers are shrinking. So they better invest in some growth.
Yeah. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Author A.J. Verdell's new memoir of her friendship with a late icon, Toni Morrison, is jet-propelled. Every sentence launches a new, more invigorating one. Take this opening paragraph. When you open the door to Toni Morrison, you look genius in the face. She was a legend while she lived. Now that she's gone, she's a literary monument, a beacon, an ancestor, an everlasting eidolon, thriving in a weightless world. Eidolon means a spirit or a shade. A.J. Verdell makes you look up words like that. As an angry black child in a Catholic school that ignored her talent, her best friend was a dictionary. Her 1995 novel, The Good Negress, the story of a young woman discovering her own worth in 1960s Detroit, is part of the canon now. Toni Morrison called it extraordinary. But Verdell never imagined they'd meet. After all, Morrison helped create the canon as an editor at Random House, who, as Verdell says, helped unerase black writers. And then Morrison became one, writing The Bluest Eye, about a black child who thought if she just had blue eyes, she wouldn't be so ugly. Beloved, which featured Setha, an escaped, traumatized slave. There was Song of Solomon, Paradise. Morrison won a Pulitzer, a Nobel, National Book Awards, a Presidential Medal of Freedom. A.J. Verdell writes about their friendship, but also gives us much of her own biography and a masterclass on writing from both women. It's all unspooled and then braided up again in A.J. Verdell's new book, Miss Chloe, a memoir of a literary friendship with Toni Morrison. And A.J. Verdell joins us. Welcome.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful introduction.
Oh, I'm waiting for you, the creative writing professor, to tell me that I've used cliches.
No, you haven't. No, you haven't. But, you know, in creative writing, we are really interested in precision. And I wasn't angry. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
And that's how the dictionary became my friend.
Okay, we'll talk more about that. But first, interestingly, that both you and Toni Morrison changed your names, claiming who you really were. I mean, you went from Angela Jones to AJ and took your grandmother's name, Verdell. Toni Morrison was born, if I've got this right, Chloe Ardelia Anthony Woford. Why did you call her Miss Chloe?
I was looking for a way to address her respectfully, but without saying Miss Toni, which sounded kind of crazy. Toni just was too casual for the monument that I thought she was. All the years that I spoke to her, I called her Miss Chloe, and it was a way that she could know who I was right away. Nobody else used that term.
When you called, it was deferential. You compare her to James Brown in that she was black and proud and changed the culture. As you write, once you read her, your vision could not go small again. Just briefly, remind us of a young black girl in particular, what some of the characterizations had been before Toni Morrison.
Before Toni Morrison, we tended to be somewhat invisible. She presented an intimate, kind of dim environment that we were in. I often refer to it as living under a low sky. She went into those very narrow, very oppressed environments where people live in tenements, or they have holes in their walls, or they're very poor. And she would enter those very narrow, very oppressive environments and bloom these real people who we all recognized.
Well, and again, back to you, this whip smart black girl in love with words, devouring books on your mom's shelf. You had books at home before you even knew that Toni Morrison edited them. I had forgotten that she was an editor. Books like Man-Child in the Promised Land, The Black Book, which is the must-have anthology of black writers. I'm going to, you know, toggle ahead here a little. You were accepted to Ivy League schools, but rejected what you saw as their white privilege for the University of Chicago, because, as you write, Chicago. Then at 29, and again, I'm really leaping ahead, you start to write your novel, The Good Negress. You write, you wanted it to be about a Negro nobody family. What did you mean?
I meant the kind of family that is unobserved. I was trying with The Good Negress to write a story about the differences in how we raise boys and girls. And the young girl in the center of this story is really trying to renegotiate her place in the family, really trying to come back and endear herself to her mother. And her mother had left her with her grandmother for a little while. So they have a lot of tension inside the household. So the unobserved family is just as dramatic and just as dynamic as a fictive family. Mm. And that's what I tried to play out in the novel.
Sort of what like John Cheever does. In reading your book about Toni Morrison, I went down the Google search rabbit hole because I was remembering things. And I want to pick up on this idea that this was a family, a Black family. There's an interview online with Charlie Rose and Toni Morrison. He asks her in a wince-inducing moment, when's she going to write something that's not about race?
Right.
Oh, right. I mean, and she was so patient, I thought. She wasn't always. She was so patient in this moment and said, well, are you going to ask James Joyce, if you could, when he's going to write a book that's not about race? His books all were about Irish people. How does that hit a Black person?
Hit is a good word, Robin, because it does hit you. I think it's an abusive question to ask Morrison, when are you going to write something that's not about race, when really she's writing about Black people? She's writing about people who you say are different than you.
What the person who's asking is really saying is, when are you going to write a normal book which has white people in it? Because that's normal. And as you point out in your memoir, Miss Chloe, if you look close enough, the white people are there in many of the books. They might be with a hand holding a whip over a slave.
Yes.
But people don't want to see that.
That's right. That there are also white people in Morrison's works who are more benevolent than most of the malignant people who are there. And my opinion had been, people can't see the white people in Morrison's books because they don't want to see that malignancy in themselves. Mm.
One of the threads in the book is you explaining where your next novel has been. You describe this new book you're writing about, Black Cowboys. And at first you have a supportive editor who dies. And then you describe this tortured process working with primarily white editors who want to tell you how you should present Black figures.
Correct. But it's sort of the same coin as, well, when are you going to write a book about real people, meaning white people? Basically, what I figured out was it didn't make a lot of sense for me to keep trying to respond to a white editor's perspective on what a Black male hero would be. This started to just go on too long and it was too much. And
well, here's where Toni Morrison, who usually could give you the side eye and tell you very, very succinctly what she thought about something, she told you, who's writing this book? You.
Exactly.
Skip the agent, skip the editor, get a lawyer and go publish it. And you couldn't.
I could not. It's correct. Because I felt that she was offering me that advice from the vaunted perspective of her standing. In fact, the example that she used was Bill Clinton. She said, Bill Clinton published his book. He didn't have an agent. He didn't have an editor. He had his lawyer and that was it. And so when she said that, I thought to myself, well, I am not Bill Clinton and I am not you. And maybe that's not going to work for me. I felt fine not doing it until she really got mad at me for not staying in the publishing world. Mm-hmm. And that's when I thought maybe I should have tried what she suggested.
Well, now she's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the last words of your book, the things you say she taught you. You have the whole past to work with and you have only now to work. Mm-hmm. Don't be scared.
Yes. She was really a strong, mighty force. And she believed that the antidote to all the cacophony around us, all this incorrect material about who we must be, which is not who we are, we counteract that by living out our gifts. That was her religion. Live out your gifts and you will be fine.
A.J. Verdell, her book is Miss Chloe, a memoir of a literary friendship with Toni Morrison. A.J. Verdell, thank you. And we're waiting. We want the cowboy book.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And I started out by worrying that she'd call me out on cliches. That's because A.J. Verdell has a list of them that she gives out every year to her creative writing students, first at Princeton with Toni Morrison, now at Morgan State University. You can check that list out. Check yourself. And also read an excerpt of Miss Chloe at hereandnow.org.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to reclassify one series of bat from threatened to endangered. Northern long-eared bats can be found anywhere between Maine and North Dakota. Thing is, a deadly fungus killed nearly all these bats in Wisconsin, and researchers are now working to prevent more from dying, as Susan Bentz of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
Five researchers cluster outside the bat hibernation location in southwest Wisconsin. They don headlamped helmets, disposable gloves, and hazmat suits to keep them from spreading disease from one hibernaculum to another. But this sounds more like a family reunion. When scientists Kate Lanwig and Joe Hoyt first came here, they were working on graduate degrees. She in Boston, he in California.
You guys are like family. It's been over a decade, right?
Yeah. Now Lanwig and Hoyt are married and are both associate professors at Virginia Tech. This bat hibernation site is one of 250 in Wisconsin. They, along with their grad students, survey in partnership with the state's Department of Natural Resources. Many of the sites are privately owned. The department tries to keep the locations hush-hush because it's critical the bats remain as undisturbed as possible during their hibernation period from October through mid-May. All I can say is this one is in caverns beneath a large old building with plenty of opportunities for bats to find their way inside. Once underground, the researchers quietly set to work, searching every chilly crevice for drowsy bats, often tucked out of sight. They note the temperature. From a distance, the bats appear to be little reddish-brown balls of fur. The team inspects each bat for evidence of fungal invasion. That means looking for areas covered with the white-colored fungus or for wing damage caused by it. One team member takes a sample of the bat's skin by swabbing its muzzle and forearm, then weighs it.
15.42.
That's just more than a half an ounce, the weight of 3/4. A bat can lose up to 1/3 of its body weight during hibernation.
Band number 10082.
This bat is already banded, but if it wasn't, an aluminum-lipped bracelet would be affixed around its forearm. Then the bat is gently placed back where it came from. Over the years, four bat species have been monitored at this site, including the northern long-eared, the species the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering for endangered status. Sometimes as many as 16 bats have been found hibernating here. This year, only 6 were found, all of them of the big brown species. Scientists have learned that deadly white-nose fungus thrives in the same dark wintry conditions in which bats hibernate, and bats are really good at spreading the fungus around. In addition, the fungus lives on even if bats aren't there.
Can we get out?
Back in the open air, Kate Lanwig says although they weren't able to stop the white-nose syndrome in its tracks a decade ago, they started amassing useful information.
About what does the disease do to populations as it first invades? How do we see prevalence of infection, intensity of infection change?
Now they're focusing on characterizing the survivors.
What's special about them? How are they able to get through this?
Langwig's team is studying how temperature and humidity, where those bats hibernate, factor into the puzzle.
Our research has found that within the range that bats hibernate, the warmer temperature is actually the warmer caves, the fungus grows a little faster, kills the bats faster.
At the same time, her lab is uncovering evidence that surviving bats are developing resistance to the disease. Lanwig has been studying bats for 15 years, ever since white-nose syndrome first emerged in the U.S. Lanwig was only an undergrad then, but she was hooked.
They're, of course, our only flying mammal, one of the most diverse diets of any taxa on the planet. They're having this sort of double effect at helping out crops and probably forests and other ecosystems. So they're really an important species.
One that will have a long road ahead of it, repopulating.
They have only one baby per year. So unfortunately, that means it's going to take them a really long time to recover. But I hope that it also sort of demonstrates to people how interesting they are.
Lanwig says she's cautiously optimistic. Her team is seeing individual bats with the disease survive the winter months. She hopes to help uncover what makes their survival possible. For Here and Now, I'm Susan Bentz.
And before we go, art prices, some like it hot. You may be familiar with Andy Warhol's iconic image of Marilyn Monroe. It's called Shot Sage Blue Marilyn. It sold yesterday for $195 million at Christie's Auction House in New York. That is the most ever paid at auction for a work by an American artist. I wonder if Christie's is free to run Pledge Week. Anyway, this painting is one of five in a series of brightly colored images of the blonde bombshell. Warhol painted it in 1964, 2 years after she died. FYI, the previous auction record for an American artwork was for a painting by Jean-Michel Basquiat in 2017. It sold for $110.5 million. But, you know, inflation. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.